Hello, Peter C. Haywood here with another solo episode of Fun Problems. Just for context, AJ is in charge of all the recording and editing, and he, I think, made a mistake, or there was some kind of bug, and the last episode he recorded, actually the last either two or four episodes we recorded, his audio is a shambles, so he's working on that. If you've ever worked on this kind of project, you'll know that that kind of obstacle really kind of creates this big speed bump, and it's really hard to get going. But he does want to get going. It's one of his big plans for 2024 is to get regular episodes coming out again. So this is the 15th episode in a row where I'm apologizing for no episodes. But it is going to be an episode. It's going to be a one-take Peter solo episode. Which means I'm just going to ramble into a microphone, not edit it, hope that it's useful, send it to AJ to make sure I didn't, you know, say anything particularly offensive, and then upload it. So today I want to talk about a thing that I think about a lot in game design. By the way, these, if you're listening to all the episodes consecutively, like it might just be 2 weeks for you. It's been many years for us. So if I say stuff that I've said 1,000 times before, I apologize. I may have made this exact disclaimer before, I don't know. I know that when I was binging podcasts back in my podcast binging days, I would hear the same story 6 times and be like, "Whoa." Yeah, now that I've lived it on the other side, like I sit down with the microphone for 2 hours and then don't think about it again for 4 years. So apologies if I'm repeating myself, but hopefully a different take on it's interesting or it's new. Okay, that's all the disclaimers. Let's go. So the thing that I think about a lot in design is the way that players instinctively play your game is correct. And that's quite a bold statement, but I am a huge, huge, huge fan of elegance in games and removing barriers. Like, you know, already the process of a game is abstracting a concept. So I'll use Village Pillage as an example, just because that's probably my best known game. I'd say so. Maybe that time you killed me is taken over. Let's just go with Village Pillage. So, Village Pillage, you are playing a village, and you're fighting two adjacent villages, and you're sending one of your guys off to the left, one off to the right, and you're revealing and resolving. And none of that, none of that really maps to real-world actions. If you actually run a village, you don't really have a left and a right and send one guy to each side, and all of it is very abstracted. So you're making the players do enough work just at the act of sitting down and moving bits of cardboard together and pretending it's something else. So I am a huge fan of removing any obstacles. Now, to an extent, I'll talk about that in a moment, but to use a generality, removing any obstacles between the player and their understanding of the game. The way that I tend to think about it is, you know, the fun part of your game, for the most part, is not moving bits around. It's the strategic decisions. Now, again, there are exceptions. There are very, very tactile games, you know, in Cracks of Quedlinburg, it's quite fun to pull the clicky-clacky pieces out of the bag. But for the most part, I'm not a tactile person. I don't like bitsy stuff. I don't like moving stuff around. Like, the reason I like board games is not because it's physical and tactile, but because it's a puzzle where everything is laid out, or it's a unique way of communicating with other humans. Those are the two things I like about board games. I don't like the bits. So whenever I'm designing or developing a game, one of my primary focuses is how can I get people's hands moving less? Like, I don't want you doing stuff with your hands, because I don't like doing stuff with my hands, and if you design a game, you will play that game probably more than anyone ever, or unless you're very successful, in which case there'll be some diehard people, or if you're very successful, everyone will play it more than you do. But for the most part, if you make a game, whether or not it gets published, you're probably the person going to play it the most, so you want to design to yourself. So for me personally, I don't like moving bits around. I'll do it if I have to, though it's a good way of like tracking information. I understand the purpose of it, but if I can remove a bit being moved, if I can, yeah, remove the transfer of bits around the table, I will absolutely do that. So when someone's playing a game, they're moving bits around, which I don't like. They are doing some abstracting, and you wanna make... There's a quote, I can't remember it exactly, you can probably look it up. You don't want the you want the interesting decisions to be what the game is, not understanding the game. Now, again, there are always exceptions. You know, Barbara is You is my favorite game, and that's all about understanding the game. But for the most part, when you're making a game, You're setting up little challenges, little puzzles, little interactions. That's the fun part, not comprehending your rules. I've heard some people argue that maybe Lacerda, like there are some designers where the game is actually trying to understand the rules. I think I've heard this about. I'm trying to. I think Dinosaur Island is a game that I've heard come up in this regard, where it's like you've just got 17 plates to spin, and the job is to spin the plates and work out how they interact. That for me is not interesting. I don't particularly like Dinosaur Island as a game. It's just not for me. So that part of it is not interesting to me. I don't like having like understanding the game is an obstacle to what I consider the fun part of the game, which is solving the puzzle. again, Barbara's View is such an exception because working out how the game works is the puzzle, but that's a whole different realm. That's not what how almost any board game works, nor is it how a board game should work. So I like to remove those barriers to getting to play the game. And so a very important part of my process, and I'm sure I've talked about this before, is cold play testing. I did a whole episode of this on Board Game Design Lab. You can go listen to that. And in cold play testing, I very carefully watch how people instinctively, intuitively want to play the game. So I'll give the example of Robotopia. My unpublished game that we've talked about on this podcast as much as anything. In Robotopia, and I'm sure I talked about this on the design diary or at some other point in the process, you have these worker spaces and you're placing robots on them. And then there's the master robot who basically moves around clearing the board. So if you can move the master robot to an area, it clears that area, you get cubes for the workers that you've placed there. It's a nifty little system. It's going to come back probably 2025 in some form. It's going to be good times. And so that is a really, it's a nifty little puzzle. So I sat down with some poor, poor gamers who were not heavy gamers in the slightest. I'd just given them like an hour of business advice. So they were very like, "Oh, we really want to, give back. We really want to help you out. Can we play?" I asked them if they wanted to play my game. They're like, "Yeah, we'll absolutely play it." And it was very clear immediately that, this was just way out of their weight. They were like exploding kittens rather than Fatal Assault gamers. And Robotopia was just way heavier than they're expecting to, way heavier than they wanted to deal with. And so it was one of the most useful cold play tests. Oh, cold play testing is when you give them the rule book and the bits, and you sit back and watch. And it's one of the most painful things you can do as a designer, because up until the point where you start cold play testing, you have been Mr. Helpful. You've been like, "Oh, let me explain how this works. Oh, you've misunderstood a thing. Oh, you've missed a thing. Let me correct that." Cold play testing is a really vital counterpart to that, because your game needs to live and die without you there running it for people. There's a designer, I don't know if we've told this story before. I was once shared a room with him at Metatopia, and for 2 hours straight, he played the game for all four of his playtesters. It was one of the most bizarre things I've seen. He'd go to the next player and be like, "Now you could do this, which does this, and then this that does this, and then this does this. Good. Next player, you can do this, and then this, and then this." And so it's just really interesting watching this guy play the game for four players. And I'm sure he got plenty out of it. It's useful to, just move the bits around on the table, but it was one of the strangest experiences. So cold play testing is the opposite of that. And it's so painful because the first draft of your rule book sucks. I've been doing this for over 10 years now. Trust me, the first draft of my rule book always sucks. I sit there and cringe and wince and cry and just apologize to people profusely. But it's such a vital part of making the game better, because when your rule book sucks, when people don't know how to play the game, when you're not there correcting people, you see what people will naturally do. So in the case of Robotopia, they were blind play testing it. Sorry, they were cold play testing it, and they had to move the master robot to a section of the board. But robots go on spaces, so when they moved the master robot, they didn't move him to a section, they moved it to a space. And I was like, "Oh, that's so much better. Like, that's now part of the game. It makes everything work better because the robot's a robot. He goes on spaces. Robots go on spaces." It just worked really nicely. And so a big part of that was a big move in the development. This has happened on countless games I've worked on. Like, I couldn't even tell you how many. Every time I sit down and make people cold play test the game and make them sounds harsh, but oh, it's a miserable experience for everyone. Every time people are cold play testing the game, I'm sitting there watching them and seeing what they do intuitively. And if what they do intuitively is not what the rules say, I change the rules to what they're doing intuitively and balance around that. And that can mean a lot of rebalancing. That can mean reworking the game, not quite from the ground up, but like substantial changes. And as a result, I believe my games play quite smoothly because people are able to play intuitively. So, you know, if the game makes you do something that's completely unnatural, and I see this a lot in prototypes, including my own prototypes. Alex Cutler, who I just went and stayed with, and I had a game, and we were pushing, mostly I was pushing this incredibly unintuitive thing. And you know it's unintuitive when you and your co-designer, who've played the game countless times, are also forgetting it. So we had this rule in that I really wanted. It was so interesting and puzzly and thematic. But the fact that we forgot it meant, of course, that the first time we played it with other people, it was constantly me being like, you can't do that. Sorry, that thing you're excited to do? No. No, you don't get to do that. Hey, stop having fun with this game. I'm sorry, I know you thought it would be fun, but nope, I'm here to tell you. No fun allowed, stop doing that thing. And immediately after that playtest, as you'd expect, we eliminated that rule. I don't know if I have any other examples that spring to mind, but trust me, it's a thing that happens a lot where I'll be playtesting a game. Or this is actually really useful for when you have those, like, which way should it be? And as you design kind of heavier games, or even sometimes lighter games, you run into these countless, like, it could be this way or that way, and it really doesn't matter, like, for the balance of the game, for the fun of the game, it doesn't really matter which way it is. Always go with what is intuitive to new players, in my mind. Now, I'll get into exceptions in a minute, but if you do that, then when people sit down and maybe they're not great at rule books, maybe the rules video they skimmed, or maybe they're tired, or maybe they're just not into games of this weight, they're not constantly messing up and feeling dumb. And if the moves are intuitive, if everything they do is intuitive, then they will intuitively do it. And it just removes this layer, this barrier between them, the player, and your game. And that's such a big thing for me. I love removing those barriers. Accessible is a big part of my ethos, and I just think that if you can remove those unintuitive rules, if you can switch the game to how people play intuitively, they will have a better time, you will have a better game. I think it's really good for everyone. Now, the cost of it, of course, is that it can take a lot of work. the phrase I use a lot is do the work. Yes, it takes a lot of work sometimes to change, especially core rules of your game, to be more intuitive. Do the work. If you want to make the best game that you can make, you gotta do the work. Now, I'm not saying do unnecessary work. I don't think you should, you know, throw out your game after 10 drafts and start again just in case you randomly stumble upon a better way of doing it. But when it comes to stuff like intuitive actions, I strongly, strongly, strongly believe in do the work, do the work, do the work. Now, there are exceptions to this. There are exceptions when the intuitive way to play flattens the game. So, for example, Decrypto. Decrypto is one of my favorite games. It's one of the, I think it's just outside of the BGG top 100, but it's a very, very popular game. It took the Codenames formula and kind of amped it up a bit, at the cost of being incredibly unintuitive. Teaching that game is a nightmare. I've taught it many times. I was taught that game by a room full of drunk people, so I just had no idea what was happening until about 3 rounds in, and then I got it. And that game, the trouble is, if you don't get it, it can crash hard. When I teach, here's a little Decrypto tip for you. If you're teaching Decrypto to all new players, stay as the clue giver for a few rounds. Because the example I could think of was like the clue was wheat. And, you know, I gave the clue of like Catan or something like that. And the next player was like bread, which is a fine clue. And the next player was like grain. And it was just like, oh, well, now it's very clearly wheat. Those are made up examples. But there are definitely times when if you don't get it, the whole game just ends. So when I'm teaching Decrypto, I tend to stay as the clue giver for a few rounds until everyone really understands it. Because that game is very fragile. That game is not intuitive, but it's absolutely worth it. Absolutely worth it. So I'm not saying 100% of the time, you know, if it's interfering with the core of your game, if the core of your game is that friction, that tension between, you know, limited communication co-ops are a really good example of this. A lot of the time, the intuitive thing is just to say what the words are. But at that point, there's no game. So if it's absolutely going against the core of your game, then keep it in, and you'll quickly work out if the core of your game is worth it. There's also times when players are coming with particular baggage. So just to make up a random example, maybe a war gamer is used to things working a particular way. And if they sit down and try to play your game, they will intuitively do things maybe differently than you intended. So I'm not saying every time a player does a thing intuitively, you know, they could have just played, Fury Dracula and be like, oh, your combat system is kind of like Fury Dracula. Let's run it like that. Fury of Dracula? The Fury of Dracula. I don't know what the middle word is. Fury something Dracula. So if they've just played a bunch of Dracula Fury and they're like, ah, the intuitive thing is to follow those rules because I just learned them, that's not necessarily useful data that I think you should, you know, follow up, that you should accept and receive. And if it goes against the core of your game. But in a lot of other situations, I really think if players are consistently intuitively doing the wrong thing, this is one of the many reasons cold playtesting is so valuable. If you constantly have to correct players the same way, cold playtest your game with players who have never done it and see what happens if you're not there to correct it. And if they're just doing this whole other thing that's not what you intended because you're not correcting it, that's a sign that something needs to change. And almost always the answer will be change that unintuitive rule. Change it to something more intuitive. Watch what the players are doing and change it to that. Robotopia was a very easy fix. Instead of the robot going in a quadrant, he went on a space. Great, done. One-to-one, you know, they want to do this. That makes sense. It's different mechanically. I'll rebalance around it. Great. Easy peasy. Done. Sometimes it's much harder than that. Like if you have a combat system that your whole game's built around and people keep on, I don't know, wanting to re-roll blanks. That's a weird example, but let's say you're in your game, the numbers go from low to high, except for threes are the highest and twos beat fives, and people cannot keep this in their head. Ask yourself how vital that is. You know, when someone's looking at a bunch of dice rolled and they're like, aha, I won. And you're like, well, actually, no, because that two beat that five. That's not a good sign if people are, if you're taking that moment of joy away. Like that moment of joy is what your game kind of ideally is building towards, like giving people those little rushes, those brain chemicals that we talked about at length. And if your rules are getting in the way of that, I think that's a problem with your rules that you should seriously consider fixing. Now, fortunately, it's a fun problem, the problem of fun. And genuinely, that's one of, like, I just spent the last 3 hours working on a little auction game, and I played it against myself about a month ago, maybe a month and a half. And I kept on getting it wrong. So I was trying to make an 18 card game because I've been working with Button Shy a lot lately. In this game, you draw two cards and you put one out into the auction and the other is your bid. So you're sort of using one item to bid with and the other item is what you're bidding on. And with 18 cards, that means for each player, you need two cards each round. So if you do the math on that, in a two-player game, that's four rounds. Four items was not very interesting. So at the end of that, I had you shuffle up the discards and go again. And then if there was still enough, shuffle up the discards and go again. But then it was so unintuitive. And this is me playing against myself. So obviously this is a very early time to make a change. I was just like, I can't calculate if there's another round in. I'd be halfway through dealing out the new round and be like, oh, there wasn't. And this game was ideally meant to go beyond two players and the math was weird and awkward. So I made it a 60 card game. So now it's not no longer a Button Shy pitch. I'm working on it as a 60 card game. That's what I spent 3 hours doing, upgrading the abilities and powers from 18 cards to 60. This game might never get made. This might be the most impact it has in the world being in this podcast. But that's because I just wanted to be like, cool, when the deck's over, it feels like the game's over. That's what I want. That's what was intuitive to me. When the deck's done, the game's over. And with 18 cards, I just couldn't get there. So rather than being like, well, you just have to learn to keep shuffling and not shuffling, I said, nope, forget it, 60 cards. And then when the deck's over, the game can be over. So even at, what's that, four? That's 15 rounds if you're playing two players, which is a lot. I'd probably reduce it from that even. But if you're playing a four-player game, that's 16, oh, what's the math on that? 16, 32, 48. That's probably three rounds. I don't know, maybe that math's bad, but maybe it'll be a two-player only game. Who knows? But the point is that by seeing what was unintuitive, I rewrote the whole game around that rather than forcing this unintuitive thing in. So the earlier you can catch that, I tend to call playtest very early these days. Like, I'll play a few solo games, I'll play maybe one or two games against other people, and if the game's working at that point, I'll cold playtest it, because I want to find those pain points as early as possible. There's a game of mine, The Vegas Strip, currently being developed by John Brieger, friend of the podcast. He's been on before, published by Allplay. And there's a rule in there that we're actually debating right now, whether this works. So in that game, you are bidding, but to give you a very brief overview, you know a secret. You know that one of the places that you're going to is corrupt. And the rule is that you can't bid your highest piece there. So, you know, you have currency that you're bidding. In the first round, 7's the highest. If you know that a certain place is corrupt, you cannot bid your 7 there. Brieger's suggestion, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, you know, how the sausage is made, but it's a really good point, was, hey, what if instead of saying you can't play there, at the end of the game, at the end of the round, you just take away the 7 if it matches the one that you know is corrupt? And that is a really interesting point, because on the face, it is more intuitive, you know, rather than have a thing of like, you made a mistake 6 turns ago and you broke the game. It is more intuitive to just be like, and now this one gets taken away, and you're like, oh no, it got taken away. Oh, I shouldn't have played it there or whatever. I don't know how we're going to land. This is genuinely in debate at the moment. My kind of counter argument is that you get a lot of information from people playing their highest one, because you're like, now I know that one's not corrupt for you. And sort of to my own cold playtesting point, I've never seen anyone make that mistake. So I don't know if he has or if he's just future proofing, which is totally valid. I don't know where we'll land on it. But it's the kind of thing where there were probably 7 other unintuitive rules, but because I cold playtested the game so quickly, I was able to cut. It also really makes you simplify your setup, cold playtesting, because now people are like, okay, this goes here and this goes here and this goes here. So that is... my note says rewriting your game to what your players want. Oh, yes. So the other time not to do that, I'm glad I read my own note before stopping, is if it's just not a game for them. So I have a bad example, which is Dracula's Feast. People came into Dracula's Feast wanting to role play, basically. And so I got all these things of like, well, can't I role play? And it's like, if you ever play Dracula's Feast, the goal is to keep your identity secret. So role playing is the exact opposite of that. And so for the game that I was trying to make, that was a very bad note. And people were like, but I want to role play. And I was like, no, you cannot. Now that I'm, 6 years on from the latest publication, probably, when was that came out? 2017. 7 years on from when that first came out, and maybe 5 years on from the second edition, I think the game has a problem in its nature, which is that you want to play it a certain way, and the game's like, nope, it's not that kind of game at all. It's because I didn't really understand market fit, etc. And so this is a particularly poor example, because maybe I should have listened. But if people are coming into your heavy strategy game wanting to be exploding kittens, cool. You don't have to change it to what's intuitive for them. But I still think that there is value in seeing what players do while trying to play your game intuitively. And I hope that was helpful. That was a long ramble. Let me know if you enjoyed this, because if so, I will do another one maybe about market fit. That's another thing I've been thinking about a lot. Ooh! Or if there's any topics you would like to hear, just pop onto our Discord. It's the Jellybean Discord. I'll put a link in the show notes, or maybe AJ will. And we'll be back as soon as we have... Well, I'll either be back with a new solo episode, or we'll be back once we have technical difficulties sorted out. But thanks for continuing to subscribe. You're rad. I like you, and hopefully we'll be back soon. I should do some self-promotion, I guess, at the end here. What's happening? I've got a new game, Things in Rings, coming out, also developed by John Brieger and also being published through Allplay. Very happy with that one. My Button Shy games just all came out, so Converge is a three-part series. You can play any of them individually, but they mix and match. And Apropos of Movies and Apropos of Board Games are really fun little party games that are very hard to get their hands on right now, but when they're back in stock, you should check them out. I think that's all the stuff. The Critic Kitchen Pledge Manager just opened. I got games everywhere, so go check out all the games. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back either with AJ or with another solo episode. It's up to you. The power is yours. Bye!